Hello and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This monthly show airs the third Friday of each month and focuses on classical homeopathic treatment, how it can benefit your entire family, and especially how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name is Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting today from Portola Valley, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area. And today's show is going to air for the first time on June 20th, 2008. Well, welcome, everybody. I hope everybody is enjoying the beginning of summer. It's hard to believe that summer is already here. Very exciting. First, let's go back to some current events. You know, I always like to talk about what's going on. And today, I'd especially like to dedicate this show to my mom. She had her 93rd birthday at the end of May. And so I want to say happy birthday, Jeanette Lansky. And I also want to thank you, Homeopathy, because it has really been instrumental in helping my mom live such a long life. Over 10 years ago, my mom's sister died. It was her best friend in her whole life. I thought she was going to die then. And homeopathy helped bring her through that, and since then has helped bring her through some pretty severe health problems. And, you know, she is declining. She's 93, but she's still being helped by homeopathy. And so I really want to thank homeopathy for helping my mom live into her old age in a pretty good way. And she's totally with it. So thank you, homeopathy. So other current events, you know, one thing that's on all of our minds these days, because it's filling the newspapers, is politics. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about what's going on politically in homeopathy. One thing that's really exciting is some interesting alliances are being built between the National Center for Homeopathy and other like-minded organizations. You know, I've talked before about the attacks going on homeopathy, especially in England, but they're starting to come here to the United States as well. For example, recently there was an article in Consumer Reports that completely said that homeopathy was worthless. They based their information on erroneous information. They didn't speak to people who knew about some of the latest studies. It was really poorly done, so I would warn you all not to believe what you read in Consumer Reports. But anyway, in response to that, I think I may have mentioned on a previous show that Peter Gold, the media person for the National Center, did talk to the people at Consumer Reports and actually set up a conference call between the editor there and some of our top scientists, Dr. Iris Bell, who's a professor at University of Arizona, one of our leading researchers, and Professor Rustam Roy at Penn State, who has done some cutting-edge work on the structure of water. He used to be, he may still be the chairman of the Material Science Department at Penn State, and has done some amazing work that shows that that the water, you know, in which homeopathic remedies are made, is not just water, and in fact now devices can be used to identify the signatures of specific remedies and even of specific potencies of those remedies. So apparently, after listening to this, the editor at Consumer Reports opened his mind perhaps a little, but was still not willing to retract what had been said in their reports. Anyway, back to alliances. One thing that the National Center has been trying to do is to build these alliances, and actually a couple of them I suggested and have come to fruition. One of them is an alliance with the Organic Consumers Association, which is an organization I really like, and they have a huge membership, and they sent out an action alert to all their members to tell them about this Consumer Reports article and to send complaint letters to them. So that happened. It was a great thing for homeopathy. A new alliance that's just in the process of being formed is with the Weston Price Foundation, which some of you parents might know about because it's an organization that's very focused on diet. health and diet. And so that is another alliance that the National Center is forming. So all in all, sometimes when these attacks happen, you know, maybe homeopathy can come out stronger at the other end of this. It's forcing us to get together and, rally the forces, close the wagons, form alliances, and become stronger because of these crazy attacks on homeopathy. And what that all boils down to, too, is what I always do is plug the National Center for Homeopathy. We need all of you to join. You know, our membership continues to decline, and yet what we offer to our members continues to increase. And so you get so many wonderful benefits, including like Materia Medica online and Homeopathy Today, their wonderful magazine, which if you're a member, you get delivered to your house as well as online availability. And we're going to be even beefing up the website things even more. We already have so much there, hundreds of articles. But we're hoping by the end of this year to have a social networking component to sort of like Facebook that's for people interested in homeopathy. So we have so much planned. Just go to nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org to find out about joining. So before I go on to today's show, just let me remind you to go to theimpossiblecure.com website and find out all about my book, which is always the basis of this show, impossiblecure.com, and there you'll find a page about autism treatment and the annotated archives of this show, which I encourage you all to listen to old shows, the Cure Stories database, please add your own story, how to order in bulk or singly, and referral list to homeopaths. And don't forget, you can always email me at lansky@impossiblecure.com or alansky@autism1.org. Okay, before I go on to today's show, and today I'm going to be interviewing for the second time John Melnichuk, who is a homeopath who treated my son Max and cured him of autism. And since that time, actually, Max was John's first autistic patient. And since that time, John's practice has grown in this area, and now is over 50% of his practice is autism spectrum kids. So he has a lot more insights he'd like to share. I think he was on the show 3 years ago. Was it 3 years ago? Yeah, I think it was 3 years ago. So since that time, he's told me he's really feels like he's developed a lot more understanding of autism treatment. So I invite him back on the show. Now this summer, just a little preview, as many of you know who've listened to my show before, I go away every summer. My family goes to Canada. And so I am actually going to be out both July and August this summer. So I don't know what Autism One will do, if they'll rerun the show both July and August, but sometimes usually they do. But I'm not going to do a new show until September. And my plan for the September show is to talk about, sort of give an overview of the various homeopathic organizations in the United States and Canada, and, well, especially the United States, and what their roles are. Sort of a little bit of a political show there, I guess. Also, in the fall, I hope to have an interview with Luke DeShepper. Many of you know him. He's another homeopath who treats autism. And I also hope, I haven't asked him, to have an interview with Dana Ullman, who wrote a book that came out this year about, or maybe it came out last year, about famous people who use homeopathy. It's a really fun book. It's called The Homeopathic Revolution. So, and then, I have said that my plan is to close up this show, do my final show in December. I'll see if I stick with that, but I am planning to, and I'm hoping that the Autism One people will rerun the show for quite a while, so we'll see. So let's move on. Let me begin by introducing John Melnichuk, who obviously is a really beloved person to me because he was my introduction to homeopathy. He is the person who helped cure my son Max. And so, obviously he is a very important person in my family's life, and we've since become very close. He is like an uncle to my sons, and it's always great to have him on, although I am going to have him on. Although he's local to me, I am going to have him on over the phone. So just to tell you a little bit about John, although I'll ask him to introduce himself. John is born in Canada, born and raised in Canada, and Edmonton, actually. And he came to the United States, after Canada, he went to England to study homeopathy, and he'll tell you how that all came about. So he studied for several years in London at the London College of Classical Homeopathy, and then also did his advanced studies at the Dynamo School. And then these are both very well-known homeopathic programs in England. And then he came to Palo Alto. It was real interesting because he chose Palo Alto because at the school in London, he met a woman there from Palo Alto who actually just interestingly turned out to be somebody that is also was a friend of mine from graduate school, Wenda O'Reilly, who ended up getting into homeopathy too. Both of us got into it independently, and she ended up doing the translation of the Organon that many of us use, which is Hahnemann's tract on homeopathy. She did the latest translation. But anyway, she encouraged John to come to Palo Alto, and shortly thereafter, about, I guess it was probably about 6 months after he came to Palo Alto, we found him, and my road into homeopathy and Max's recovery began. So John has been practicing, I guess, for about 14 years in Palo Alto, and he is a wonderful homeopath, and partly because of my book, his practice has grown to include a huge number of ASD kids. Although in general, John has always liked to treat children, and especially what people consider to be incurable conditions. So he's also had success with cerebral palsy, mental retardation, and other complaints. So so John just loves to treat kids, and so he's a wonderful practitioner. So without further ado then, one more thing. John is going to be speaking. I've always talked about the national conference. And next year's national conference is March 27th, 28th, and 29th in Seattle, 2009. So, and John is going to be one of the featured speakers at that conference. He's going to be talking about autism. And in fact, I think Luke DeShepherd is also going to be speaking about autism. So it's going to be a very autism intensive conference next year. So I hope many of you will, especially if you're in the Seattle area, will plan to come. So that's, I believe it's March 27th, 28th, 29th. It's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Seattle area in 2009. Okay, so without further ado, I am going to bring on John. Welcome, John.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Great to have you on the show again.
It's nice to be back. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I've told everybody a little bit about you already and how you help Max and how you've been treating a lot of autistic kids. What percentage of your practice do you think now are ASD kids?
I think on the spectrum, I think about 60% of my practice is that. Maybe, and it varies, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but about 60% I'd say.
Wow.
I have a lot of experience with treating kids with autism and Asperger's, cerebral palsy, things like this, and ADD, oppositional defiance, seizure disorders, and other kind of neurological complaints. That's an interest for me in my practice.
Yeah, I've heard that you said you even treated cerebral palsy.
Yeah, I have many kids, actually, that have done really well with cerebral palsy. And the younger they come, the better, generally, just the same as with homeopathy and with autism and Asperger's and other complaints. If you catch them early, the kids generally do better. But even I've had a kid who was 15, and he was slowly better with homeopathy over the course of about a year, getting better and better. And his tendons and ligaments, which were very floppy, he couldn't really support his own weight, became strong enough with homeopathy that he began to be able to stand a little more on his own. And he was always wheelchair-bound. And he's speaking just a little bit more. So it's a long, long-term case. but the kid is doing well.
That's great.
Yep.
Well, before we start, I always like to ask people how you got into homeopathy, and I think yours is a sort of an interesting case, too. So.
Well, I think my case is not so unusual when you talk to other homeopaths or people in other healing professions, that I came to homeopathy because of an arthritic condition from which I suffer called ankylosing spondylitis. And it was a very interesting kind of time in my life, a pretty tumultuous when I was in my late teens. And I wound up eventually, after some years of suffering with arthritic symptoms and no diagnosis, going to the Mayo Clinic when I was about 21. And the doctor said, oh, we know what you have, but we think Western medicine isn't the best thing for it. You should try something else, some alternative medicine, and watch your diet and do exercise. And homeopathy has turned out to be one of the most helpful things for me. Osteopathy has been helpful. Acupuncture has been helpful as well. But really, homeopathy has been the mainstay for me. And I've lost some range of motion, or quite a bit of it, over the years. But I've been quite well with homeopathy, and I've gotten a really good treatment from many great homeopaths. So I came with my own arthritis.
Yeah, you came because you were helped. You know, I mean, I guess that you're right. That's how everybody, even, you know, that's how I got into it, too, because my son was helped. So so often that's the case. So, you know, one thing, you were starting to say how you successfully treated an older kid with multiple sclerosis, but I know now you've had some amazing successes with older autistic kids at this clinic. Tell us about that.
Oh, it's been interesting. In the last several months, I've been working with kids from a group home who were formerly diagnosed as being retarded, but their diagnoses have now been reevaluated and re-diagnosed as being autistic, a lot of these kids. And I've seen four kids from this one facility in the East Bay. And so far, I'm 4 for 4. It's really exciting. I met with one girl this morning who's 17, and she would not talk at all, really, before. Her hygiene was bad. Her mother complained that her hair smelled, her breath smelled. She wouldn't talk, and she wouldn't really be interested in doing anything. And in 4 months, we got to the point now. She's still living at the care center. She'll need to be living there for some years, I think. But we're going to get her to read now. She went home for Mother's Day, hugged her mother for the first time, said, I'm so happy to be home. She went up to her room, gathered her books and toys, sat down, started to play with them, and asked her mother to read to her. This hadn't happened in years and years. This is the first trip home since January. And the trip in January, she was home just for a meal and didn't spend the day. Also on Mother's Day, her older sister took her shopping for the first time ever, 23-year-old girl. It's a 17-year-old girl who was at the home out shopping, and they had an afternoon together for the first time. And school has noticed, social workers noticed, the doctors have noticed, the caregivers have noticed. So we've got her reevaluated for an educational program, and we're going to get her to read now. She wasn't able to read before. She's maybe at a kindergarten level. And we're going to give her a little more ambitious academic program now since she's more available and more interested. The other thing is that she stopped hurting herself. She was pinching herself and bruising herself quite a lot. And this is completely gone now over the course of 4 or 5 months.
Oh, my God. It's so fantastic.
So we're really excited for her. I think that I'm hoping that we can get her through. I think her intellect is still intact, and I think we can get her reading. Right now she's 17 years old, and she hasn't lived at home for about 12 years, I think. Many years that she hasn't been at home. And she's in a great facility now with a great nurse and a really kind staff who are very, very caring for all the kids. The other kids I'm seeing at the care center, a couple of boys who are really wild, hitting, destructive, hitting themselves, hitting others, headbutting, stuff like that. And they're about 80% less violent than they were 4 months ago. And we changed their diets as well a bit, helped them go on a gluten-free, dairy-free diet. That's one big problem for a lot of these kids. And even just by changing the diet, that's helped both these boys and this girl as well. They started losing some weight. And two boys there's less trouble on the school bus now. They're not as not making as much trouble on the school bus for the driver and so forth. And one of the more severely affected guys, who was really very violent, he's last week we got a report from the school that he was able to sit in circle time, and he wanted to dance with the other kids rather than being off on his own. So we're getting somewhere, and actually in a relatively short order, we're getting a pretty good response for these kids. And in a certain way, because their symptoms are so severe, it's a little easier to pick the remedy sometimes in this kind of situation. So that's what we're doing. I'm quite excited about it, I have to say.
Yeah, I know that one of your dream things is to start some kind of facility for autistic kids, you know, sort of a center. So maybe this is a good entree for you.
Oh, that would be a great dream, is to have a one-stop shopping for parents and caregivers to come and get their kids evaluated, learn how to cook for the kids, and get a treatment plan for the kids, rather than having to fly across the country to different specialists. That we could do that in one center in a residential setting where people might come a week at a time and have a bit of respite and get educated about how to help their kids and get some support. So that's what I'd like to do, and this may be the beginning of it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful dream. So one thing, you said that you've had so many kids now, ASD kids on the spectrum, that you're starting to be able to differentiate, like, sort of subclasses and etiology, you know, how they became that way. You're starting to have more deep insight into this and how to treat them. So tell us more about that.
Well, what I should say is that the ability of doctors to diagnose autism is better than it ever has been. When I see kids now, compared to kids I saw 5 years ago or 10 years ago, the diagnosis is more accurate. And there's better treatment available, actually, in the schools now, and even in Western medicine, that they're beginning to understand that diet's very important for these kids. For me, when I see the kids now, I've seen enough kids where the pattern for vaccine-related autism is pretty clear. And a child who suffers from autism related to MMR vaccine looks different and behaves differently and has a different genetic inheritance from a child who is affected by another type of vaccine like DTaP, the diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis. And I've seen kids with autistic symptoms from the flu vaccine, from mother getting injected in the third trimester with a flu vaccine, a couple of those last year.
So what is the different appearance, like, let's say, for MMR versus?
Well, the timeline of onset is different, and those kids tend to have a little more trouble socially and with speech as compared to DTaP kids, where kids are affected negatively by DTaP. Those kids have speech problems, but they also have more motor control problems, where fine motor skills are not quite as good, gross motor skills are not quite as good. There tends to be more seizure activity with kids who are affected by DTaP. And we know that about the vaccines anyway, that diphtheria and the acellular pertussis vaccine has a higher incidence of seizures, and the kids are usually more reactive to that sort of vaccine if they're susceptible than the MMR. You'll see a reaction with a DTaP vaccine almost immediately, and with MMR, it tends to come on more slowly. What you used to see is that with the classic case, when there was thimerosal in the vaccines, which there aren't now in California, I think, that the timeline would be the kid was developing just fine, maybe a little precocious, up to about 12 months, and then they'd get the MMR shot, and speech would slowly disappear, eye contact and social interest would slowly disappear, and bowel problems would slowly come on. The stool would be wet and mushy and quite smelly. But by 18 months, the kids wouldn't really talk, and they wouldn't really be interested in anybody, and they'd have big digestive problems, and their interest in foods would become very narrow. So if they were eating solids after, you know, 7, 8 months of age, and eating peas or peaches or carrots or things like that, they'd lose that interest over the course from 12 to 18 months. They'd really only want milk, and they'd want bread. Those are the two things they'd really want.
So this is more the way Max was.
And, yeah.
More that dreamy quality, or?
They tend to be less violent as well. The kids, you know, they tend to be more angry if they've had a DTaP reaction than the kids who have MMR. The MMR kids tend to be more mild, actually, in their disposition. And the way that they're affected with the AS, you know, with the autism spectrum symptoms, is that they're not as angry. They're just more disengaged. The one thing I should say about the bread and the milk, I mean, almost all the parents I see with kids who are truly autistic say that there's a benefit from putting a kid on a gluten-free, dairy-free diet. And I found that a lot with a lot of kids. For some kids, it doesn't help, but most of the time, it's worth trying out, although it's difficult to do and stressful for parents sometimes. But there's a lot more resources now, even in the last, again, in the last 5 years. There's a lot more cookbooks. There's a lot more prepared baked products and mixes to help you with pastries and desserts and so on. And a lot more knowledge about nutrition for autistic kids. So that's all shaping up. To give a comparison about what a DTaP kid looks like, who's been affected by that vaccine, it's more often there's a hot spot right at the site of the injection and a fever following that night after the injection. One thing that sort of prevents that from showing up is the use of Tylenol before and after the shot. In some doctor's offices, it's common to recommend that a child take Tylenol before he comes for his shots and then Tylenol again after he gets the shots. These kids, if they've had a vaccine reaction, I find them much more difficult to treat effectively.
Yeah, you've said that you think Tylenol is a big, big problem in the autism community because of this.
Yeah, I think what happens is that when somebody has a vaccine reaction, that their liver will get very busy trying to detoxify the body. That's the job of the liver, or one of the jobs of the liver is to detoxify the body and protect it from chemical invasions or poisonings. It's the main organ that works when you have a hangover that you're trying to get cleared out. Your liver gets active. But when you take Tylenol, it shuts off the production of something called glutathione, which is a chemical that the liver makes to help detoxify the body. And the kids who are reacting and have a very high fever after an injection, their body is trying to resolve something, and the body is trying to protect and cleanse the body from whatever's in the vaccine that's harmful to it. And by giving Tylenol, it slows that process down or stops it sometimes. And then the chemical poisoning from the vaccine that the kids are kind of allergic to stays in the body, and that results in long-term damage. And it's much, much more complicated, and the damage is much more difficult to resolve if there's been Tylenol before and after the shots. If there's Tylenol only after the shots, that seems to be easier to help the kids. But it's still much slower than if the kid had a fever that burned even at 103 or 104 all night after a shot. Doctors are usually very nervous about this sort of thing if a high fever comes up after a vaccine because they're worried that the child will have seizures. In my experience, it's not the absolute temperature that comes up that's the problem. It's the rate of rise of temperature in a fever that tends to be more the problem. So a child could, if they're having a fever that comes up, they could have the seizure already from 100 degrees to 102 degrees if the rate of rise of temperature is fast enough. And by the time you give the Tylenol, it would be irrelevant anyway. And I think having, you know, anything over 104, I think definitely is a dangerous sort of thing for a kid to have, if you're even an adult, and you have to cool them off, you know, do just basic common sense things like undress the kids, use damp, cool cloths, or put them in a tepid bath or something like that. And if the fever doesn't come down, you could use something. It's just as simple as Belladonna, and most of the time that will help the kids avoid needing more Tylenol.
So you've said that you've also seen, like, been able to distinguish, like, the etiology for, like, PDD and Asperger and that stuff, too. And also, I'm curious, do these differences affect how you treat, or, you know, do you have different approaches for each of these subclasses?
Which question would you like me to answer first?
Okay, well, I guess answer, like, the PDD Asperger one first.
So, some of the testing for kids about their intelligence and so on comes up, and they're diagnosed as PDD-NOS, which means pervasive development delay, not otherwise specified. And this tends to be kind of the fault or garbage can diagnosis when a child is not functioning well, but doesn't meet all the criteria for Asperger's or autism. They might not be speaking, they might not make good eye contact, but they also usually have significant bowel problems and what they call motor control problems. So the kid they'll be late walkers if they're walking at all, or they won't be learning their ABCs, or they won't be making eye contact, things like that. And that pervasive development delay, they just don't pick up and keep up with the other kids. They fall further and further behind. So they might have 1 year of social development at the age of 3 or something like that. And they can test in their intelligence very low. But I think this is misleading in a way. Asperger's kids usually have very high vocabularies, and the etiology is a little different for PDD. PDD-NOS, I usually see that there's more of a problem in the pregnancy. And something happened to the mom. She got a medical treatment. She had a tough time in the pregnancy. She suffered physical abuse. She was a drug user or got medical treatment of some sort, or she had traveled a lot. Sometimes I've seen several kids over the years where the mother has had a really tough international travel on an airline, and the mother's gotten in kind of a distress late in the pregnancy or early in the pregnancy where the kid has actually been dehydrated and lost amniotic fluid because the mother's been throwing up all the way across the Atlantic to Eastern Europe and all the way back, or to India or something like this. And those kids get in distress, or the mother's had spotting or a significant bleed or needed tributyline or something like that in the pregnancy to prevent a pregnancy from terminating itself. Those kids tend to have more problems, and their progress, if they're truly PDD-NOS, is slower than with autistic kids.
So those kids are harder to treat than the autistic kids.
I think so, because it's like taking bread out of the oven before it's baked. It's almost like they're preemie babies that didn't have a chance to finish their development in the womb in ideal conditions. But this is the reason I think these kids.
So where you feel like the kids who are more truly autistic are more the vaccine damaged kids.
Mostly, but I've seen some kids, like not all, and I can't say honestly that vaccines are the cause of autism or Asperger's and things like this. But I've got a number of kids I'm seeing, maybe 15% of the kids I'm seeing, where vaccine etiology we can't really see. It's just not, either the history is incomplete or we just don't see a reason for it. And that's a bit mysterious to me. But the strategy for treating is about the same, because in homeopathy, the very best results always come from giving an individualized prescription, no matter what the diagnosis, whether it's Asperger's or cerebral palsy or autism or something like this. That I know a lot about giving therapeutics for homeopathic for these complaints now, where you give a medicine which is helpful for the condition, but not truly what they call individualized to the person. This is a bit of a complicated subject in homeopathy, but suffice it to say that there's a lot of different ways you can use the remedies, but the best way is still for an individualized treatment, regardless of the diagnosis. But understanding the physiology of the situation is different for kids. But just going back now to differentiate between Asperger's and the etiology of that compared to autism and pervasive development delay. So mostly I see pervasive development delay. There was trouble in the pregnancy, and the mother got some kind of treatment, or she had some ailment.
Would you give a remedy in that case that pertains to what the mother's complaint was in the pregnancy?
Sometimes. It depends on, if I can't get an individual picture for the kid, I'll do that. And the results then will be slow still. If I can find an individual picture for the kid, which is not very well differentiated because if the kid's 3 years old but still operating like a 1-year-old, not a lot of data that the kid can tell you. But they're just really very delayed. But getting them to come along is very slow in the beginning. But once they start to pick up and they start to eat properly, you do a lot better. Going on to autism kids. Asperger's kids. Going on to Asperger's kids. It's more often a kind of, I see that the dads in these families usually are pretty hard-driving managers or executive types. That's what I see more of for some reason. With autism kids, more the kids I see, the dads are not so much in management. Why this is, I don't know. I don't know what it means exactly. Maybe it's just a little oddity in my own little practice here in Silicon Valley. But the etiology of Asperger's is also related to vaccines, I think. But there's less damage with an Asperger's kid than there is with an autism kid. The main difference in function, of course, is that the child with Asperger's usually has a very good vocabulary, very well developed. Maybe, you know, in a kid who's 7 or 8 years old, that they would have a high school vocabulary. But they wouldn't have comprehension of what the words mean in context. So it's hard for them to communicate beyond a concrete level. In the same way with autism, and it's hard for the kid to generate expressive language. The Asperger's kids generate expressive language, but only in a limited way. So when you see an Asperger's kid, you won't always notice that because they communicate very well, but you'll find out that they're very sensitive to environmental conditions. Food dyes, temperature, clothing. They're the kids that you still have to cut the tags out of the shirts with and stuff like that. And when you see an Asperger's kid will be very sensitive to things, but socially they'll be delayed in the same way an autism kid is delayed, even though they have a good vocabulary. But they're always getting into trouble, and there's always conflict at the playground and in the household because everybody expects the kid to be able to be socially mature according to the level of his vocabulary.
So how, I mean, so I'm curious how the difference in treatment, or have you been finding, is this differentiation? I mean, what you're describing is really what we're all coming to understand about these different things.
Yeah. Well, the strategy is different because it's for each kid, the prognosis is different. The Asperger's kids, homeopathy is still the homeopathy, but the mix of other therapies is useful, and managing the diet with Asperger's is no less important than with autism. I would say managing the diet for all of these children is very important because they always will test for high in allergies. But it's not really that they're allergies, that they have allergies. It's that their systems are not developed or they've been damaged. They're not functioning at an optimal age level. And you could say that if you gave an infant some chili peppers, you could say that you'd be crazy to give that to an infant. But you could also say that the child had an allergic reaction to peppers or something like this. So when you're giving an Asperger's or a PDD kid or an autism kid a regular diet with milk and bread, you can say they're allergic, but their systems have been damaged or have not developed enough to be able to absorb nutrients from those different foods. So their progress is slower if they're on an inappropriate diet. As far as the strategy for treating with homeopathy, the therapeutic remedies, there's a slightly different group of remedies that are more often helpful for Asperger's kids as compared to autism kids. And the PDD kids need a different set of remedies from autism or Asperger's kids. But there's an overlap of all the same sorts of things. And what you can expect is a little different in the response from each kid. And the way to manage them with supplements and so on, that's also often a necessary kind of addition to the program. So we usually work with a blend of things. There's almost nobody I see in my practice who isn't giving a nutritional program or using supplements or something like that, along with a specialized kind of education.
So how often are you using, like, isopathic remedies, you know, giving vaccines and potency or?
A little more than I used to. There are some people in different parts of the world who are using vaccine-based remedies and things like this quite extensively, and they can help. There's no question about that. But I find that an individualized prescription still works much better. The isopathy of, you know, giving the agent that caused the problem in a homeopathic dose can be very helpful for some people. And I've begun to understand picture, unique or individualized picture for MMR vaccine and DTaP vaccine particularly, and a little bit of flu vaccine. I've seen enough of that where I could sort of individualize and pick a picture of that. But those work well when they're the indicated remedy for the kid, not just on a blanket prescription that we gave this caused a problem, we'll give it an homeopathic potency, and that'll clear it up. I haven't seen that so much. Other people seem to find a great benefit for that. I've begun to use it more than I had some years ago, but I'm using them in a little different way rather than as kind of a protocol. There's some people who have a protocol of using one vaccine at a particular dose for some period of time, and then they go on to the next thing, and then they go on to the next thing in a higher potency. And I think that has some merit, but I haven't found it to work as well as the way I was trained to use single remedies at a time on the basis of what they call a global totality of individualized symptoms for somebody.
So tell us about some cases that you've been seeing with success, more cases. So, you know, and maybe give us an idea of why you think certain cases were more successful or, you know?
Well, for some kids, I'll succeed very well and I'll know why. And sometimes I won't succeed and I'll know why, too. And there's a group of kids where I'm not succeeding and I haven't completely understood the situation. But for, you know, sort of a simple autism now, if I see a kid who's between 2 and 5, we can do very well and very quickly. It's very rare now that I don't get somewhere with those kids. And the more challenging kids for me now are old, I'm working with older kids. So the very young kids, I've sort of sorted that out where I feel like I've got good results. There's a little boy in Los Angeles I've been seeing. And in 18 months, he went from not responding and not talking at all with tantrums and hitting to the point where he's mainstreamed. And we've probably got another 6 months or so where he's going to be not needing so much homeopathy anymore. And it's one of the fastest responses I've had. That's unusually fast. And we've changed his diet. We got him to a good school. And the family that, it's a single mother who's raising this boy, so it's not a high-income family. And the kid's doing just fine. I mean, it's really quite a spectacular success. There's other kids I see, another little boy who was 4, and was covered head to foot, very severe eczema. So I've worked with him, and over the course of a year, the eczema is just a little patch on his ankle now. It's about 1% of what it was in the size of what was covering his body, and it's about 2% of the severity of it. This kid couldn't sleep. He was scratching till he was bleeding. He had to use steroid creams. They had to give prednisone, things like that, and he was autistic. So we got the eczema cleared up, and now we're working on his speech and so on. And just in the last month, his mother told me that he started speaking sentences. This is in our, I think, 14th or 15th month of treatment, and he began addressing adults by name. So we're also very happy with this little boy. And it goes on from there. So I have, I don't know, too many kids to talk about, actually, but most of them are doing very well. And if they come early, we can get a lot done, and the potential for a complete recovery is much better than if parents are waiting.
Is there like a breaking point where you think, I mean, I know that if you come later, it's still worth coming, of course, but is there a point where people should really come before that point?
Well, as early as possible, I would say, because the closer to the time of the injury or the onset of problems, the more effectively the body will reply and sort things out. There's more plasticity in the child. If somebody comes after 10 or 12 years of being autistic or Asperger's, the whole family dynamic has also shifted to accommodate the child, and that tends to perpetuate the behavior, even if the child heals and the physiology changes to be more healthy. So, but, you know, the break point, I think, is puberty.
Huh.
Once hormones come in for boys or for girls, it becomes more difficult for the kids to cooperate, because in puberty, you know, kids don't cooperate. They go through the teens and they start differentiating, and they're much less cooperative than they would be before. And trying to manage a kid and have a kid change his diet when he's in puberty, he'll want junk food or she'll want junk food a lot. And that will be a big battle, that if you're able to change a diet early on in their lives and teach them to eat well early on, their opportunity for recovery is much better than if they're eating inappropriate foods and junk foods, pizzas and things like this, which would be unsuitable for them. So, you know, puberty makes it more complicated, but even with this care home or this residential facility where kids are wards of the state sometimes, we're actually getting somewhere, and I sort of got to a break point last year where I understood in a clear way what we need to do for this other group of kids now. So my experience and ability has brought me to grow my skills, I guess. And I'm happy and looking forward to treating, you know, a generation of older kids now.
Are you finding still that nozotes are really commonly used? We know that in Max's case, carcinosin, I still hear cases that it's a very prominent remedy used. I mean, do you think nozotes are more important, or is it just one among all of them?
It's one among many. I mean, carcinosin, the cases that it helps most are most related to MMR autism, I would say, because in the genetic inheritance of the family, there's usually some sort of cancer, heart disease, and diabetes there. And carcinosin would be one of the remedies which would often be helpful. But it's not, you can't give it a recipe and say that's always the remedy for somebody or it's the best acting remedy for somebody. I've seen too many cases where that hasn't panned out. We have to really carefully individualize and select a remedy on the basis of somebody's disposition, not just on the basis of their genetic inheritance. So it's a helpful remedy. Other nozode remedies, morbillinum and other sorts of things, I've had good cases there, metarinum and other sorts of things. All these different sort of remedies have a place to play, but they have to be used on an individual basis.
What about the LMs versus dry? I mean, I know that some homeopaths say you've got to use LMs. And are you still using both?
I'm using both. The majority of kids I see, if they're very young, they tend to do better on the LMs. The older kids, they also do better on LMs, but it's not always practical to give them, depending on where they're living. A few kids I've seen, they don't do as well on LMs as they do on the dry C potency doses. But that's more rare. More often I'm using LM doses because a small dose of something every day is much easier for everybody to tolerate. And it helps the physiology develop more gently and recover more gently than high doses at long intervals.
But in this group home, maybe the high potencies, you're using the higher C potencies?
No, I taught them to use LMs.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, and they're going along with it, and they're really excited because the staff, I mean, are not getting beat up as much. And the kids are actually settling down now, so they're actually interested in learning. And that's just in the last 6 months we started this, so it's going very well.
I've always said I think there's something about LMs where you're doing something every day that it's almost an intentionality factor going on, too.
Yeah, I think it's a mindfulness practice as well.
Yeah.
So just but I think also the way that the LMs work in terms of the stimulus to somebody's organism to get it to heal, there's something that's not available in the dry doses and for some people. But there's exceptions both ways. That some kids have done very poorly on LMs and we give C potencies and they do great. But the majority of kids, I would say, more than 80% of the autistic kids I see, maybe even 90%, I'll give LM doses first of all as a place to start and find out that's a better way to go.
So what about, like, I don't know if I asked this last time about chelation. I mean, what if somebody comes into you and says chelation, what do you say?
It's variable because you have to see what things complicate the treatment and how damaged the person is, because in a state of health, the body will chelate itself. It'll be able to clean itself of even some metals and so on. But the more toxic somebody gets, that diminishes the ability of the body to clean itself. And once you get past a certain breakpoint, the metals just pile up, and the body can't excrete anything, and the kids are stuck. So one of the things that you can do is chelation, and that becomes quite a balancing act. The people who know most about this, I think, are the DAN protocol doctors. And I took their training to find out what they were doing to learn about what they're doing and to see what comes up. I'll never see the kids who do extremely well with DAN protocol. They won't need to do homeopathy, even though they can benefit from it. Their parents will be satisfied and the doctor will be satisfied that there's satisfactory progress. But I find that the main thing is that with chelation, that the supplements are too aggressive, because when a chelation is given, it strips out normal minerals that people would need to function. It'll take out iron, it'll take out zinc, it'll take out copper, it'll take out manganese, it'll take out selenium and other kinds of trace elements. So when along with the heavy metals, the mercury or the lead or whatever, or tin or whatever else is part of the problem stored in the child's body. And what they'll have to do as a balancing act is put in supplements. But if they're overdosing with supplements, all the chelation gets to is the overdose of supplements, and they never get to the heavy metals. So the kids can actually go backwards from having too many supplements. That's the main thing I see, main mistake, but particularly young DAN docs. The people who are more seasoned are a little more gentle about it, I think, and a little more. They also have to individualize for every kid they see, and a lot of docs do quite well, but they're hard to find. They're really experienced docs who are not just applying kind of a protocol. With chelation, you know, some of the kids I've seen I haven't been able to help. That it's been a matter that they've been really heavily poisoned. And what it mostly looks like is either really serious mercury poisoning in the worst cases of autism, or very heavy lead poisoning. But more often I see, you know, mercury, see kids drooling and sweating and having big rashes that don't heal up, even though, like, very bad eczema. It will almost look like ulcers, you know, bleeding.
So will you give mercury in those cases?
Sometimes. It depends what else is going on. I mean, there's other remedies which are possible. Like there's a remedy called Mercurialis perennis, which the English name is dog's mercury, and it's like a what they call a plant mercury, a vegetable mercury. Podophyllum palpatum is another vegetable mercury. Those remedies sometimes are very helpful, and not just, you can't just say, it looks like mercury poisoning, just give homeopathic mercury. There's other remedies sometimes that will do a better job, and I've got several cases where that's, you know, we found that to be more useful than just mercury.
What do you think of hyperbaric?
It can be helpful for some kids. I've seen some kids do better with that, and also with acupuncture. That's another treatment that sometimes has helped for the kids. And I see that it's more often the Asian community, particularly Chinese families who have autistic kids, will take their kids for acupuncture. And no doubt that that can be helpful if you have a good practitioner.
So what about, have you been treating many kids from a distance successfully?
I've been treating people from around the world for several years now. Kids in Singapore, in Ireland, in England, Germany, in, you know, all over America, some kids in Canada, Costa Rica, and elsewhere. And we can do well, but it's much more difficult to get an excellent result than if I see somebody here locally. Even if I can meet the person the first time here and have a visit with them, I generally do better than if I have to do it all by long distance, where I see somebody on the internet or they send me a videotape of their kid and then we have a telephone interview. I can still get results, but it's more often therapeutics, and I'm not as good at getting individualized prescriptions for these kids. So they benefit, but not as much as if they were local, I think, or if I could see them from time to time on a person-to-person visit, face-to-face.
Yeah, I agree. So,
but it's still worth doing. I mean, I would say that it more often winds up that I give a series of therapeutic remedies for kids who are at a distance because I just don't understand them as individuals as well as I could otherwise. And when I meet with parents over a course of time, the most work and expense really comes in the first year. And a lot of my job, I spend teaching parents about health and about how the body operates according to homeopathic theory, how it cleans itself, how to understand a beneficial symptom as compared to a problematic symptom. Because a lot of times with homeopathy, you'll trade symptoms. So a neurological symptom will clear up. The kid will give you more eye contact or a little more speech. And he'll get a skin rash or a tummy upset for a little time or a fever. And in medicine, the answer would always be to give a cream or to give a Tylenol or something like that to make the kid more comfortable from those things. But in homeopathy, they're a sign that the body is cleaning itself out and actually chelating itself. And as it does that, symptoms have to go somewhere. And if you treat a little physical symptom or a little physical discomfort or a neurological gain, that's very important to keep. And helping parents to understand that and have confidence in their children's bodies' ability to recover is a major part of my work. It's not just about giving out remedies. And that's all. I do better with people when I can sit down with them face-to-face and answer their questions. It's a little bit more difficult if I'm having to deal with English as a second language, although I've done pretty well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're almost out of time. So is there anything you want to say just to conclude?
Keep trying homeopathy for your kids. Find a good local homeopath. Find somebody who's got a track record with doing homeopathy. And, you know, we as much as the other treatments have come up, hyperbaric oxygen, acupuncture, GAN protocol, Amy Yaskel and other people have been learning how to help kids with autism and Asperger syndrome and pervasive development delay. We've all been learning, and homeopathy has come a long way. In my own practice, I've come a long way, and a lot of my colleagues who I've been teaching now have come a long way as well. You know, I was teaching in Wellington, New Zealand in November of 2006. I put on a seminar for homeopaths who are unfamiliar with autism and autism spectrum complaints, and that went very well. And we see now that there's a lot more activity in New Zealand with kids coming for homeopathy, and the homeopaths there are getting more success as a result of their work and our lectures together.
I also told you, when I introduced you, I mentioned how you'll be speaking at the national conference next year. So.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
It should be a good time for all of us. And I just spoke last month at the California Homeopathic Medical Society, and I gave a short lecture there and presented a few cases of autism for people. And that was generally well received. So I think that the advantage I have is that I know the physiology and clinical symptoms of these complaints very well now. as compared to other homeopaths who haven't, have seen a case or two here and there. I've just seen a lot. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to solve every case I've got, but there's a learning curve to all this, and I'm just, you know, consistently more effective year by year as I go on with this. I look forward to more challenges.
Well, thank you so much. I feel so lucky. I was the first one.
Well, I have a debt of gratitude to you as well and your family. I mean, it's been delightful to see Max develop into a young man and very exciting to see him go wonderfully well in all aspects of his life.
Yeah. He's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Amazing kid. So thank you for the gift of bringing Max to my life.
Yeah. Well, thank you. So... I'm gonna say goodbye. We'll pause, and then I'll say goodbye to you privately.
Okay.
So hold on.
Bye.
Well, that's all we have time for today. We really ran late. Before I go, I want to give you the website for John's practice. It's paloaltohomeopathy.com. And his name is John Melnichuk, Melnychuk. So it's paloaltohomeopathy.com. And once again, also don't forget to check out impossiblecure.com, nationalcenterforhomeopathy.org, and also there's a new Yahoo group, homeopathy-and-sn for special needs at Yahoo Groups, so you could join that new discussion group as well. So have a great summer and be well, and remember, there really is hope with homeopathy.